Radhakunda. Giddy Govardhan Ki Jai. Vrindavanam Ki Jai. Mathuram Ki Jai. Navadeepam Ki Jai. Jagannathaswami Ki Jai. Yamunamai Ki Jai. Srimati Lassi Devi Ki Jai. Samaveda Bhakta Vrind Ki Jai. Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bom. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Okay, so Om Ganat Tivananda Shah Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur and Meditam Yenitasmai. Shri Gurave Namaha. So today is the appearance of Lord Vamana, the dwarf incarnation of Krishna, and also the appearance of Srila Jiva Goswami, the most erudite, that means the most, let's say the best scholar. You know, the word erudite is kind of big for some of you. The most erudite scholar of all time, basically, and he's acknowledged as such by practically every major Indologist, the person who studied Indian philosophy. And he's, of course, famous for the Shatshandarbhas. So we'll speak a little bit about that. But first we'll talk about Lord Vamanadev. Of course, Lord Vamanadev's story starts with Prahlad Maharaj. Because Prahlad Maharaj, of course, was the great devotee who was saved by Lord Nrsimhadev. And Prahlad Maharaj got married. He had a son named Varochan. And Varochan had a son named Bali. Bali Maharaj. And it's interesting, when Lord Nrsimhadev killed Hiranyakashipu, he gave Prahlad Maharaj, right afterwards, of course, he gave Prahlad Maharaj the benediction that none of Prahlad Maharaj's descendants would ever be killed by him, by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's a pretty good benediction. And so, you know, in addition to Bali, you had other descendants, too, who were protected because they got that benediction. Anyway, we don't need to tell that story. So continuing, but Bali Maharaj, being born in the family of Prahlad Maharaj, was born in a demon family. And it's not that because you're born in a daitya or a demon family that you're necessarily a demon. Like there's many people born in devotee families that are demons. But we've given the example many times before when Krishna's own son, Bhomasura, became a demon. And that's a devotee family, having Krishna as your father and Bhumi as your mother. You can't do better than that. Right? Who's your father? Krishna. So he became a demon. So, and there's many examples of demons or rakshasas, or like Vibhishan, or malechas, like so many people that Prabhupada preached to in Kali Yuga, becoming devotees of the Lord. So we don't want to discriminate on the basis of the family heritage. So in any case, Prahlad Maharaj was a devotee, but Bali Maharaj was also a devotee. But because he was with the demons, he had to do his demon duty, which is to fight the demigods. That's the dharma of the demons, I guess, to fight the demigods. And usually they would try to take over Amaravati, which is the heavenly planets. So they would attack Indra's abode and fight with them. And it's interesting, the demigods could not be killed at that point. Because at that point, the demigods had achieved or had drunk the amrit or nectar. Sometime before that, you had that story of the churning of the milk ocean. And the demigods got the nectar by the mercy of Mohini Murti, which we mentioned last night. And the demons also had a sort of immortality, because if they died, they could be brought back to life by Shukracharya. Shukracharya was the guru of the demons. Even the demons have to have gurus. So, and the reason he became the demon's guru is that he was envious of Brahaspati, who was the spiritual master of the demigods. Because really, Shukracharya thought he was better than Brahaspati, and he thought he should have that position. And because he didn't get that position, he opposed the demigods. And continually, he was inciting the demons to attack the demigods. And Shukracharya did some austerities to get this Mrityu Sanjeevani mantra or process by which you can bring people back to life if they died. If their body was still intact. I mean, if they had burnt the body, you couldn't bring them back to life. But as long as the body was just laying there in the battlefield. So Bali Maharaj, in one of his fights, many fights with the demigods, he died. And Shukracharya did his thing and he brought him back to life. And at that point, the demigods had committed an offense against their spiritual master, Brihaspati, by basically not paying him proper attention, because Indra was, let's say, sitting on the throne, being worshipped, his wife was there, and he was just like aloof. Aloof means like very much not even interested when his spiritual master walked in. You know, imagine the spiritual master walks in the room and you're there with your wife, like on your side, and then you don't even say, "Hi, Guru Dave." What to speak of, which is at my humble obeisances. So he didn't do that. So because of that, the demigods sort of lost their power. And the demons, because they were very devoted to Shukracharya, they got great power. And eventually, they were able to take over the heavenly planets. And that means they kicked Indra out, they kicked Vayu out, they kicked all the rest of the 33 million demigods out of the heavenly planets. There were a lot of homeless people at that point. You know, you talk about like refugees, you know, there's a big refugee. 33 million, that's pretty good. Yeah, you can't get to Fiji. Anyway, it's a lot of people. So the demigods were all upset. And at the same time, Bali had taken over the heavenly planets, but he wanted to assure that he could remain in the heavenly planets. So he started to do this sacrifice, these horse sacrifices. In the Vedic culture, they used to sacrifice animals, but the animals were rejuvenated. It wasn't simply for the purpose of eating animals, is that they would put them in the fire and then they come out with a new body. And that was the test of the Brahmin's mantra. So, in any case, they were doing this 100 horse sacrifice. In the meantime, Aditi, the mother of the demigods, got really nervous because her sons had lost their home. And she's the mother of basically all the demigods, 33 million children. And so she went to Kashyapa, her husband, and she said to Kashyapa, "Please save us, you know, allow us to get back our heavenly planet." And Kashyapa advised her to engage in this austerity called Payovrata, which basically means living on milk. Just on milk, and engage in many, many different austerities. And eventually, you get what you want from this Payovrata. It's interesting that his other wife, Diti, at a particular time, that she's the mother of the demons, was given a similar austerity to perform. And her intention by performing the austerity was to get the son who would kill Indra. And Kashyapa didn't like that much, but he was tricked by his wife into giving her that particular benediction. But he also said if she made a mistake in the performance of this ceremony, we're talking about Diti now, not Aditi, then she would get a son or sons who are friends of Indra. So what happened is that she was performing this ceremony, Payavrata, and Indra was there just watching the whole time to see if she was going to make a mistake. And then what happened, he saw that she made some mistakes. She went to sleep at the wrong time. I mean, in those days, following the Vedic rituals was very strict. Like you had to break your fast at a certain time, and if you didn't, you were a rascal. Nowadays, things are much more lenient. Don't have to worry. So she went to sleep at the wrong time, and therefore Indra thought, now I can kill the baby in the womb. So he entered into Diti's womb, and he started to slice up the kid into 7 pieces. And the 7 pieces started to cry, somehow or other. Poor lady, you know, Diti was having all this happen within her. And then he thought, well, they're still alive, so he sliced them again into 7 pieces. 7 times 7 is 49. And so they were called the Maruts. Later on, they were all born with Indra. You know, they all popped out with Indra. And they were all friends because she had made a mistake in the performance of that sacrifice. Anyway, so Kashyapa, he was able to give benedictions to his wives to perform different austerities so they could get what they want. So Aditi was performing this Payavata, and she was successful. And Lord Vishnu eventually appeared with four arms before, and he said to worship her husband. All the wives should worship their husbands. Does it go husband puja? She husband Charana Padma. Every morning. What?
No more.
No more? Well, Draupadi should do that. Every morning, you know, husband puja. So, anyway, but if you have a husband like Kashyapa, you should worship him. And so it was described, there was the plenary portion in Kashyapa was transferred, plenary portion of Krishna, of course, that was transferred to Aditi's womb. And then all the demigods, like Brahma and others, began to pray around Aditi. And then the Lord finally took birth, and when he took birth, he had four arms. And it took birth on the day called the Shravana Dwadasi, which is today, of course. Then, after taking birth with four arms in normal Vishnu form, he transformed himself into a dwarf. And he was given different presents by different demigods. For example, he was given a sacred thread by Brahaspati. And all the demigods offered him, you know, one of them a water pot and an umbrella, because he's known to be carrying an umbrella all the time. And different things, like grass, different things. So then he exhibited his Brahman effulgence, which was kind of bright. Many infinitely more bright than the sunshine. And then he went to the sacrifice. Bali Maharaj was just getting ready to perform the 100th horse sacrifice. When you finish 100, you go to the heavenly planet. You stay at the heavenly planet. He was already there. But that assures that you will actually be Indra. So if you want to become Indra, that's the methodology. But these sacrifices are forbidden in the Kali Yuga. So he went to the sacrifice by Bali. Bali was doing, Shukracharya, of course, was doing the Swaha business. Not Bali. You know, Swaha, all these mantras, Purusha, Shukta, and everything like that. And then the first thing, Bali washed his feet, because that's the proper method to receive a guest when they come to your house. And he was offered a seat. And Bali asked him, what do you want? You asked for any benediction I'm capable of giving it to you, because I'm in the heavenly planets now. So you can have, like, land, a wife, a Mercedes, whatever you want. I didn't say that, of course. But anything you want, you can have. And first, Lord Vamana began to glorify Bali Maharaj's ancestors, like Pallad Maharaj. He even glorified Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. So they were very strong. Yeah, you come from a good family. And so then Vamana, at that point, Lord Vamana Dev, he asked Bali Maharaj, I want just 3 steps of land. And Bali Maharaj said, that's not so intelligent. You know, you come to me, who's in charge of the whole universe, and basically, I can give you anything you want. You know, a kingdom. You know, what to speak of, one wife. I can give you 100 wives. You know, anything you want, you can have. And Lord Vamana started to preach to him then. And he said, actually, if one cannot be satisfied with 3 steps of land, one will never be satisfied with anything. As we hear in the Bhagavad Gita, Avritam gyaname tena gyani no nitya vairina kama rupena kontiya dushparena amalena cha. Anyone know this verse? No. This verse is, thus one's intelligence, avritam gyanam etena, isn't covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust. Kama rupena kontiya. And what happens? Dushparena amalena cha. It always burns. And the more you try to satisfy the lust, guess what? It burns more. isn't it? Just like eating. I mean, it may appear like you try to satisfy your tongue sometimes by eating different things. So it may appear that it diminishes when you've eaten, when your belly is full. You can't eat anymore. It may appear, oh, I'm not hungry anymore. I'm satisfied. But next time, you'll be more lusty. You want to eat more, and eventually you expand. Not plenary expansion. You expand horizontally. You understand? Horizontally challenged. That's the politically correct language for someone who weighs too much. You can't use the F word anymore. Anyway. So what happened is that that Vamana said to Pali that, you should be satisfied, or I should be satisfied with three steps of land, otherwise I won't be satisfied with anything. And Pali then took his water pot to signify that he was going to offer. This is a Vedic method of offering someone a benediction. Put some water in and sprinkle it. But Shukracharya, his guru, said no. Don't do this. This is Vishnu. And if you give this dwarf Brahmin who is Vishnu his best of land, he'll take away everything and then he'll send you to hell. Pali Maharaj said it's better to go to hell than to be known as a liar, a sinful liar. I will never lie. But then Shukracharya said it's all right to lie in certain circumstances. It's all right to lie if you're flattering a lady. Now, don't. This is Shukracharya. It's not me speaking. I'm not actually saying that this is a good idea. But Shukracharya, who is the guru of demons, and actually called Shukracharya because he's interested in the seminal succession rather than the actual disciplic succession, said this. He said, when you're flattering a woman, joking, it's all right in marriage, he said. If you're earning money, protecting life, cows, or the Brahmin. Now, I would agree with one of those things. It's all right to lie if you're protecting someone's life, or cows, or the Brahmins. For example, if, let's say there were a bunch of dacoits looking for a dwarka, and he was hiding out in my room, and the dacoits came to the door and they said, have you seen dwarka anywhere? If I say, no, that's a lie, but it's all right to lie under those circumstances. I would say, I don't know where he is, or he's back in TV right now. That would actually be all right to lie. And if I told the truth, it would be sinful. If I said, well, he's in the room, why don't you go get him? That's not good. So certain circumstances are right to lie, but the other times when the Shukracharya is talking about, flattering ladies and everything like that, shouldn't lie. You could stretch the truth a little bit. Like, you could say, oh, that's a beautiful sari, when you couldn't care less about it. Men have to say that sometimes, isn't it? What a nice sari. The men are thinking, but they're not lying, because it is a nice sari, but they don't give a damn about it. So, that's not a lie. Okay. So Bali disagreed with this proposal of Shukracharya, and he said, look, the earth cannot bear the weight of a sinful liar. And Shukracharya got so angry with him, the guru got angry, he cursed him to lose everything, to be bereft of all the opulence. And so then Bali became determined to offer this land to the Lord Vamadeva, and he went to his water pot to pour a little water out to signify the offering. And the water pot, no water would come out of the water pot. Because Shukracharya had made himself very small, and he was impeding the flow of water. He had found the spout, and he was just like sitting there, not going to allow it. And then Lord Vamanadeva said, all right, we're going to take care of him. He took out a little bit of kusha grass and poked it into the spout, and poked out the eye, one eye, of Shukracharya. So from then on, Shukracharya has been really angry at Lord Vishnu. Because every time he thinks about his eye, he just becomes very vengeful towards Lord Vishnu. So then Lord Vamana, after receiving this water, he began to expand himself bigger and bigger and bigger. In the first expansion, he covered the whole Earth planet. The second, he covered the whole universe and kicked a hole in the universe, and the Ganges water came down, the causal ocean came down. And Lord Brahma also caught the Ganges in his Kamandalu. And then Lord Brahma worshipped Lord Vamadeva, and this personality known as Jambavan, who was famous in Lord Krishna's pastimes and also Lord Rama's pastimes, circumambulated him. He just flew around the whole universe circumambulating Lord Vamana's foot. It's interesting, isn't it? But the followers of Bali, they got really angry at that point, and they wanted to kill Lord Vamana, so they got ready with their weapons, and some of them were actually killed before they even touched Lord Vamana. And Bali called them off. And basically, Vamana said to Lord Vamana, said to Bali, "You're a cheater. You promised me 3 steps of land. You can't fulfill that promise." And he had him tied up with the ropes of Varuna. Actually, Garuda said that Bali was tied up with the ropes of Varuna. Bali said, "I have a place where you haven't put your foot. It's my head." So he offered his head to Lord Vamadeva, and Prahlad Maharaj came to witness that. And of course, that's why Bali Maharaj is known for the process of devotional service named Atmanivedanam, surrendering everything to the Lord. You know, you haven't taken everything, you've taken the whole universe, but you haven't taken me. So he offered himself to the Lord. And so Lord Brahma interceded on behalf of Bali Maharaj and said, "This is appropriate punishment, don't punish him anymore." And Lord Vishnu began to praise Bali at that time. And he blessed Bali that he would become Indra in the future. But in the meantime, he would go to this planet called Sutala, where he would be able to see Lord Vamanadeva every day. And Lord Vamanadeva would be the guard on that planet. In the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Prahlad Maharaj explains that Lord Vamana was the guard of this Sutala planet because he wanted to make sure that Bali wouldn't escape and do any more problems. But actually, it was because Bali wanted to associate with Vamana Dev. And then the demigods retook heaven, and Vamana remained there in heaven, and he's worshipped by Indra. So when you go to the heavenly planets, Lord Vamana is there, and Indra is actually worshipping him. So that's the story of Bali Maharaj. Any questions about that before we go on to the story of Jiva Goswami? Yeah. Some of the lower planets have more wealth than the Earth planet. And some of the lower planets, but mainly with the lower planets, you don't have sunshine. They're lit up by the jewels on the hoods of serpents. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of wealth. But you want to go there? Leave all. So, yeah. Actually, they're sometimes called the subterranean heavenly planets. That's the description given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Subterranean means below. Or like, sometimes it's used like things in the water. Yeah, sometimes it means like below earth. Terra means earth. Subterranean means below the earth. Now, there's some films that were put out in India. There's particularly one called the Vishnu Purana film series. Anyone seen that film? And it depicts those in the lower regions as living in the water. Has anyone seen that? I mean, it's really funny. It shows them like, you know, with water all over. You understand? You've seen that? But it's not a fact that they live in the water. Subterranean doesn't mean living in the water. It just means lower planetary systems below the earth. And the demons, they don't like to live in the water. One time they went in the water. When they were trying to escape from the demigods, they went into the ocean. And the demigods were having a hard time finding them and attacking them. And especially Agni had a hard time. He doesn't like to go near water. Because, you know, fire goes near water, he's extinguished. So what happened is that they called for Agastya Muni. And they said to Agastya Muni, please drink up the whole ocean or swallow it. And so Augustine, these sages could do anything. Can you imagine swallowing the whole ocean? I mean, normally if you drink ocean water, if it's salty, you'll die. Your cells will burst. I mean, it's really dangerous. Don't do it. Sometimes people are stranded in boats for many, many days, and they start to drink the ocean water, and actually they die. I mean, it kills them, salty water. So what happened is he drank up the whole ocean like that, and then the demigods were able to attack the demons. Then the demigods said to Agastya Muni, after we attacked the demons, you should let the ocean back. But Agastya Muni, he burped, which means he digested the ocean. And then, what could they do? Then he had all these ocean beds that were completely dry. And so they were thinking, what can we do? But later on, the Ganges actually filled all these things. When Bhagirath brought down the Ganges River, then all the ocean beds were filled. So in one sense, we can say that if you go bathing in any ocean, you're getting some Ganges water there. So that's why Prabhupada said, if you can't bathe in the Ganges, you can go bathe in the ocean. In Fiji, most of the devotees are afraid of going swimming. They have this, like, sort of superstition, like Hindu superstition or something like that. And so even though they live by the water, they can't swim. When I take the devotees sometimes to... Some of the devotees swim. When I take the devotees to the beach or picnic, they wade up to their knees, and they won't go any further in. And their mothers have had dreams that they were going to die. You know what? Like, Vishwanath's mother had a dream that he was going to die in the water, so she won't let him go in the water. So there's this whole superstition about drowning. And then another thing that's interesting, usually in India, when people decide to commit suicide, they drown themselves. That's the normal procedure. Not that you should do that. But they just go in the water and they breathe in the water. And they drown themselves. So there's this whole thing about water and swimming. So it's so interesting. The Fijians, of course, they're back practically like fish. You know, the people, native Fijians, they can swim. They can swim all the way from Tavayuni all the way to Vitulevu, you know, without stopping. But the other way, you can swim. Oh, water. It's like cats, you know. Do you ever take a cat and put it near water? No, they actually get very... Very scary. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Didn't he kill a couple of fish when he followed the ocean?
Yeah, that's not described. I mean, he must have done something with the fish. Because he was vegetarian, you know. I've never had that question asked before. He must have been swallowing, you know, whatever. I mean, it was arranged so that he wasn't killing fish. Somehow or other arranged. Maybe they were transported to some lake or some other planet or something. Well, he was trying to dry it up because the sparrow was trying to get his egg. He threatened the ocean. However, Garuda does eat fish. He's one of the devotees who's not a vegetarian. It's true. He's allowed to eat anything except for Brahmins. That's it. Everything else is his food. So there's a story in the Mahabharata that one time Garuda went to a village of Nishadas, or lower class people. And he basically opened his mouth and swallowed everybody. It's there in the Mahabharata, don't worry me. So he was eating everybody, but then he felt like a burning sensation in his throat. Because it happened to be that a Brahmin went to the village one time, and he married one of the Nishadas. So he, by accident, he swallowed a Brahmin. He said, get out of my throat already, get out of my throat. And so he let the Brahmin and his wife go. So if you want to escape, you can leave them. Become a Brahmin. But otherwise, you can be a Brahmin. Yeah, that story goes. And actually, in order to gain his strength, one time he had to eat this giant tortoise and the elephant that were fighting with each other. They were so big that each time he landed on something, he broke branches and finally had to go to his Mount Mandara. And that was the only thing he could support him, and so he chewed on the prasadam at that time. And this elephant was actually as big as, much bigger than the Earth planet. Bigger than, like, the Sun planet or something like that. And it was an interesting story. Anyway.
Did he offer the village before he ate it?
I'm sure he did. He's a devotee. And if you're eaten by Garuda, I guess you get liberated. Like if you get eaten by a devotee, you're liberated, right?
Garuda's body is constantly touched by
Krishna's
body, so.
Yeah, so it's not a problem. Not a problem with being Garuda's stomach. And then, what's that other story about Garuda? I mean, so many nice stories. Oh, of course, there's the typical story that the, when he was attacking Kaliya, and Kaliya wanted to get away from Garuda, so the only place that Kaliya could get away from Garuda was in the Yamuna River. And the reason was that the sage, Shobhini Muni, who was meditating in the Yamuna River, meditating under the water. And Shobhini Muni had really, like, made friends with the fish. He considered them to be like his children, you know. He was very affectionate. Just like people nowadays, they have fish tanks, isn't it? In their homes. I mean, people think it's a nice thing, but the fish, you know, they're passing stool, you got to clean out the water every once in a while. Yuck. I mean, it's not a pet to have. I mean, if you have to have a pet, get a tarantula or something like that. Or a snake or something. So, anyway, so Garuda was going to this Yamuna before, while Shobhini Muni was there, and he was trying to eat fish, and Shobhini Muni was feeling very protective of his fish, and he cursed Garuda that, you know, you'll die if you come here again. And so Garuda will never die, however he respects the curses of a sage. But Shobhini Muni had done something very bad. He had committed an offense against Garuda. And because he had committed an offense against Garuda, his material desire, like we talked about last night, material desires started to increase. And then, you know, he was just watching the fish, and, you know, watch one fish get married to another fish. I don't know what they do. You know, that swine bar for fish. You're a beautiful fish, you know, you're a handsome fish. And so he's watching the fish, you know, do whatever they do. And he thought, well, what do they say, the birds and the bees? You heard about that before? So the birds, the bees, and the fish. So he's looking at the fish, and he's thinking, wow, I should get married too. So he went to this king, Mandata, and he said to the king, can I marry one of your daughters? And the king took a look at the sage, and the sage had been in the water so long that he was basically all wrinkly. I remember when I was young, you would take baths. And of course, none of you ever took a bath. That's not part of the native culture. But in the Western society, there's a bath in the house. You know, bathrooms like a bathtub. You ever seen them? You know, it's just not. In India, you don't see it so much. In the new houses, you do. You see, like, what, hot tubs and everything like that. So I remember staying in the bath for a long time, your skin gets a little wrinkly and everything. It looks like it's all wrinkled up. So Shobhini Muni had been in the water for years. So he looked pretty bad. And he had seaweed on his head and everything. So, you know, imagine, he goes to the king and he asks, can I marry one of your daughters? And the king looks at him, who's going to want to marry this guy? And so the king said, all right, you can marry anyone who will have you, who will accept you. And so the king was thinking, nobody can accept him, you know. He's ugly. So Shobhini Muni had a better idea. He used his mystic power and he transformed his body into that, like the Terminator or something like, you know, Rambo or Terminator. Arnold Schwarzenegger or something. But for those who are you from India, you know, Vivek Oberoi. So he made himself very handsome and he walked into the ashram. Ladies' ashram in the temple. And he and he said, you know, who wants to marry me? And they looked at him and they said, and they were all fighting each other. Me first. And he said, okay, girls. And he got married to 50 of them. Pretty interesting, isn't it? Lucky? And so, you know, after a few years, you know, just like taking care of all the kids, you know, and everything. You know, imagine the children, they cry at night sometimes. Imagine if you have 50 wives and each one has several children, you know, a lot of crying. Hospital bills, crying, and everything like that. The poor guy, you know, he realized he had committed an offense. And then he said to his wife, you know, I guess we should all take vanaprastha. So then they all took vanaprastha together, and they went back to Godhead. So he overcame the effects of offending Garuda. It's a nice story, isn't it? That's the story of Shobhri Muni. Anyway, we should talk about Jiva Goswami. Let's have to go. Okay. So Jiva Goswami, as I mentioned before, is a very important personality. And he is the son of Rupa and Sanatana's brother, whose name is Anupama. Anupama was a great devotee of Lord Ramchandra. He wasn't so much focused on Krishna. So he would always be chanting Ram Nam. And the Rupa and Sanatana tried to convince him, just chant Hare Krishna, don't chant Ram Nam. So he was unable to change because he had so much devotion for Lord Ram. Anupama actually passed away when he was with his brother, and this is why he went back to Godhead. So when Jiva Goswami, who was his young son, heard about this, he resolved not to become entangled in this material world. Jiva was about 18 years old or 17 years old at that particular time. Later on, he became the most systematic philosopher in, you know, Vaishnava history. And he was the youngest and most prolific. Prolific means the one who wrote the most literatures of all the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. And he was the last of them to reach Vrindavan. And let's see. Jiva Goswami is glorified in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's very little biographical information that's known about him. Although there is some in another book called the Prema Vilas, which is written by Nityananda Das, who is one of the disciples of Janavamata, the wife of Lord Nityananda. So most scholars say he was born in the year 1513. Let's see what else. Lord Chaitanya met Rupa and Sanatana in that particular year too. And Jiva Goswami's ontological position in Krishna Leela is Vilas Manjari. That Manjari Gopi is a gopi that assists the older gopis, always remains very young, prepubescent gopi, who remains young to assist Radha and Krishna in their pastimes. So Jiva Goswami is described to have the bodily features of a Mahapurush. That means arms that reach to the knees, and eyes that were like lotus petals. They practically reach to the ears. You see that with the deities sometimes. I mean, obviously they didn't go all the way to the ears, but it's just like lotus eyes. Most of us don't have lotus eyes. We have beady eyes. But great personalities, Mahapurush personalities, their eyes are like this. I've seen people like that sometimes, lotus eyed people. And so Jiva Goswami looked like that. And he was a child prodigy, which means in an early age, he mastered Sanskrit, grammar, poetic, logic, and what's called hermeneutics. That's a big word for all of you. Hermeneutics means how to interpret Shastra, how to explain Shastra. Because some things in Shastra are metaphorical, whereas other things are direct explanation. So this hermeneutics is an extremely important part of Vedic interpretation of Shastra. So let's see, what else here? He already mentioned that he became detached when he heard that his father had died. He worshipped Krishna Balaram deities. And then Jiva, when he was 20, he was resolved to visit Vrindavan, go to Vrindavan to join his uncles. That's Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. So when he went to Vrindavan, first he stopped at Navadvip and got the mercy of Lord Chaitanya's wife at that time. Because she was still on the planet. And he also met Lord Nityananda and got the mercy of Lord Nityananda. And then he went on a complete tour of Navadvip, led by Lord Nityananda. And that tour is described in a book called the Bhakti Ratnakara by Narahari Chakrabarti, the Navadvip Dham. And actually, also, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that in the Navadvip Dham Mahatmya. There's some indication about that. And then he went to Lord Chaitanya's house and met, as I mentioned before, Vishnupriya and Sachidevi, and he took prasadam cooked by Sachidevi and Vishnupriya. And he continued on that tour. Then he went to Vrindavan. On the way to Vrindavan, he stopped in Benares, and he took instruction in Sanskrit from this person named Madhusudana Vachaspati, who was a disciple of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And after that, of course, then he studied the Vedanta Sutras and so many other things. And even to this day, the Benares Hindu or Hindi University honors Jiva Goswami because it has its own department. He has a Jiva Goswami department in the Benares Hindu University or Hindi University. Then he went to Vrindavan and he began to assist Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami. He made friendship with the other Goswamis, as well as Bhagavananda Saraswati, Kashishwara Pandit, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, who was the author of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he went to Sanatan Goswami to accept initiation. And Sanatan Goswami, being the eldest of the Goswamis, was very humble. He said, well, actually, you should take initiation from Rupa Goswami instead. So he sent Jiva Goswami to Rupa Goswami, and Rupa Goswami tested him by engaging him in menial service. Even though Jiva Goswami was so intelligent, the training was that he should do menial service, like washing the clothes of Rupa Goswami, begging alms, researching texts for Rupa Goswami, massaging Rupa Goswami's feet. I mean, I would love to do that stuff. Preparing the palm leaves for the writing, because they didn't write on paper at that time. And very pleased with Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami initiated Jiva Goswami into Krishna consciousness. A few months had passed, and then after some time, this big scholar came to Vrindavan. His name was Rupa Narayan Saraswati. And scholars at that time were challenging other scholars. They would travel around India. They were called Dig Vijayis, who wanted, Vijay means like victory. So they would want victory over other scholars, and they would get something called a Jaya Patra. Patra means like paper. Jaya means victory. So they get a certificate, just like you have, nowadays you have the Olympics, right? And instead of a certificate, you get a gold medal or silver medal or a bronze medal. And each country competes with that. You've heard of that before? And even when people are in high school or grade school, they have these little statues they get. You have that here too? That you get, best football player or best scholar or whatever it is. We had someone who won the debating championship when they were in high school, and I joked with them and I said, well, they just keep taking them out. statue of the mouth. So what happened is this: Digvijay went to Sanatan and Rupa Goswami, and Sanatan and Rupa Goswami didn't want to waste their time debating this guy. They said, it's a waste of time, who cares? And Rupa Narayan, he was very, very proud. And so he said, well, if you don't want to argue with me, then you're frauds. It means you're cheaters. So you should just sign a certificate that I won. So in order to get rid of this guy, they were just being harassed. They just signed the certificate. And Rupa Narayan was just like completely ecstatic at that point. So he's going around showing this guy a touch with everyone. You know, I'm more intelligent. And Sanatan Goswami, look how great I am. Finally, he went to Jiva Goswami and said that. And Jiva Goswami became completely incensed. Incensed doesn't mean anything to burn. It means angry. He became completely angry, and he said, all right, you should argue with me then. So then he had a big argument with him, and he argued with him for many, many days, 7 days, on the banks of the Jamuna. On the final day, Jiva Goswami won, and it's described that Rupa Narayan had a call of nature. I don't understand what nature, call of nature is. Anyway, he couldn't control certain parts of his body, and he just ran away. And it was shameful, and great shame, and he was never seen again in Vrindavan. So Jiva Goswami wanted to share the news with his uncles, Rupa Narayan Goswami, so he went to them, and he said, basically, I have defeated this rascal. And Rupa Goswami got very angry, and he chastised him. He said, you have prematurely taken the renounced order of life. You will not be able, you have not conquered your sense of pride and anger. Mm. Anyone who rejoices in humiliating others, this is a quote, or asserts his own worth is not fit to live in Vrindavan. Therefore, you're banished, and you should leave Vrindavan immediately. So, of course, Jiva Goswami was very humbled at that point, bowed to Jiva Goswami, left Vrindavan, and he went to Mathura. It's described by some of the acharyas, he lived in a hollow of a tree, you know, inside a tree, and he only ate simple food once a day. And then that lasted for 1 year. But in the meantime, excuse me, Sanatan Goswami, Rupa Goswami's brother, really wanted to end Jiva Goswami's exile. So he went to Rupa Goswami, and he said, where's Jiva Goswami? And Rupa Goswami explained, you know, I sent him away. And Sanatan Goswami said, there's one, a teaching of Lord Chaitanya you're not following. And Rupa Goswami said, which teaching am I not following? Please explain it to me. And Sanatan Goswami said, the teaching of Jiva Doya. Jiva Doya means having mercy on the Jiva souls. But there's another way of understanding that, which means having mercy to Jiva Goswami. So it's interesting. So, therefore, they brought Jiva Goswami back at that particular time. But in fact, we can understand that Jiva Goswami was not at fault for defeating this Rupa Narayan. The reason he was not at fault is because Rupa Narayan was blaspheming his uncle, blaspheming Vaishnavas. So if someone is blaspheming Vaishnavas, we should become like fire. Even there's some injunctions, like if someone blasphemes a devotee, you have to leave, defeat him, or cut out his tongue. Now that last alternative, please don't do. You know, we don't want people running around without tongues. You know. We have enough bad press as it is. You know, imagine in the newspaper, you know, Hare Krishna's cut people's tongues out. We definitely don't want to do that. So Jiva Goswami did act properly, and he was, this example of him being chastised is actually just an example for us how one should be humble. But he had no fault in and of himself. Mm. Let's see. Other stories. Oh, there's other stories like people accused Jiva Goswami of not presenting the proper Siddhanta because he concentrated mostly on the Swakya rasa rather than Parakya rasa. And I'll explain the differences. Swakya means that he presented Radha and Krishna as being married. And Parakya means that you present Radha and Krishna as boyfriend and girlfriend. So the reason he concentrated more on the, let's say, the understanding that Radha and Krishna were married is because he was preaching to immature people, even some of his students. They were not able to understand the Parakya ras. And he was also very careful about people becoming sahajas. So, in fact, Radha and Krishna are married. They are eternally connected. And all of their, like say, Radharani's so-called husband and the other gopis' so-called husbands are not actually their husbands. It's just an illusion. So Jiva Goswami was correct. Hmm. So this is one controversy that was there. Let's see. We already said Jiva Goswami is regarded as the most systematic preacher. He was the one who trained up the next generation of Vaishnavas, known as Srinivasacharya, Narottama Das Thakur, Shyamananda. And Jiva Goswami was the one who started the first traveling book distribution party. He sent these three personalities that I mentioned, Shyamananda, Narottama Das Thakur, and Srinivasacharya, with the books of the Goswamis to West Bengal. You know, they traveled from Vrindavan to West Bengal. And, of course, when they arrived at the border of West Bengal, the books were stolen by this king and his associates, King Birham Bir. But then the king later on became initiated by Srinivasacharya and became a great devotee. And he turned his kingdom into a Krishna-conscious kingdom and made sure everyone chanted their rounds in the kingdom. He kicked out everybody who wouldn't chant Hare Krishna. Yeah, it was a nice kingdom. I made sure everybody woke up for Mangal Arati. It's better than the temple, you know. They tell me sometimes, I mean, many ISKCON temples now, it's like that. It's not like the early days. In the early days, you had everybody at Mangal Arati, and if they didn't come for Mangal Arati, they had to fast. But nowadays, you go into a Hare Krishna temple, and usually the pujari comes on time for Mangal Arati. But the other one, you may have one person, isn't it? You were telling me that, Tilakini, that you were chanting or something the other morning for Mangal Arati, because nobody else was there. So King Birham Bir made sure that everybody got up for Mangal Arati, or else they didn't eat. So that was Jiva Goswami's, let's say, beginning of the book distribution mission, the traveling Sankirtan mission. And then Jiva Goswami was so famous that the Muslim emperor, whose name was Akbar, he was actually a very nice guy, traveled to Vrindavan just to have a darshan with Srila Jiva Goswami. Of course, he was living in Agra, which is pretty close to Vrindavan. And Akbar was completely mesmerized by Jiva Goswami, and he began to patronize the works of the Goswamis of Vrindavan. And then he helped build some of the temples in Vrindavan. He played a very central role in the development of Vrindavan. And, let's say, helped to construct the temples of Madan Mohan, Govinda Dev, Gopinath, and Yugal Kishore. And Jiva Goswami also met with another personality known as Mirabai, who was a great devotee, who was a great devotee of Krishna, who left her husband, who was a king, and eventually she was poisoned. There's a whole other story about that. He also constructed the Radha Damodar temple. And in that Radha Damodar temple, Srila Prabhupada resided. In fact, Srila Prabhupada said that his eternal residence is in the Radha Damodar temple. And the devotees still maintain his rooms in the Radha Damodar temple to this day. Srila Prabhupada resided for 6 years there before he went to the West in 1965. And he translated the first three volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam there at the Radha Damodar temple and planned out the expansion of the Krishna consciousness movement. So, as I mentioned before, Jiva Goswami had a massive output of theological literature, and some of the works that he composed are, I can read out the names of some of them, Harinam Amrita Vyakarna, which is a Sanskrit grammar based upon Lord Krishna's names, Sutra Malika, Dhatu Sangraha, Krishnarcha Dipika, Gopal Virudhavali, Asamrita Shesh, Sri Madhava Mahotsav, Sri Sankalpa Kalpavriksha. Actually, there's many pages. I don't have time to read all of them. But he's most famous for the Shat Sandarbhas, the Krama, Tattva, Bhagavat, Paramatma, Krishna Bhakti, and Priti Sandarbhas. Let's see if there's any other information here. And also, oh yeah, there's another important book which is really a beautiful book about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. It's called the Gopal Champu, which I'm reading right now. Let's see. Anything else about Jiva Goswami? There's a description here about the different sandarbhas, which we don't have time to read. Let's see. The six sandarbhas represent Sambandha Gyan, Abhideya Gyan, and Prayojana Gyan. That means describing theoretically, who we are, who God is, what the universe is, that's Sambandha. Abhideya means what to do about it, how to perform devotional service, and Prayojana means what's happening in the spiritual world, or what happens when you go back to home, back to Godhead. So that's Srila Jiva Goswami. So any questions or comments about Srila Jiva Goswami?
One of the important things, I mean, for all the devotees to understand that we should not jump into Goswami's books unless we have done
Srila Prabhupada's, yeah. Actually, we should read Srila Prabhupada's books many times and understand them before we jump into the Goswami literature. Of course, Prabhupada has already presented some of the Goswami literature, such as the Nectar of Devotion, which is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and also Nectar of Instruction, which is Srila Rupa Goswami's book, too. And what other books? Oh, yeah, The Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is done by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. So, any other questions?
Question with regards to, I guess it's a guru disciple relationship. And when Guru Goswami was banished by Rupa Goswami, he didn't explain anything of what the situation was. Why did he challenge that, let's call it? So, a lot of times,
no, he was banished because he was bragging about it. Yeah, Rupa Goswami knew why he challenged him. But he, you know, basically, because he came and he was, not that he defeated him, but that he was proud of it. That's what Rupa Goswami chastised him for. And he came, you know, I defeated it. You know, it's just like, you know, someone who's Bhagavatam class, and they go up to you, great class this morning. Wow, it was ecstatic. Then you understand the person's in trouble. Giving class is not a problem, but it's how or what you think about yourself afterwards. Or even with the pujari work, you know, look at the deities. I dressed them this morning. I really did a great job this morning. I'm really proud of myself. So the idea is false pride. Like, what do they say? Amanina amanadena. That's a Vaishnava. He's devoid of all sense of false prestige, thinks of himself lower than the straw in the street. He's devoid of all, you know, like I said, prestige. And he's always ready to chant the holy name constantly. Trinadapi sunichena. Purariva sihishnuna. Amanina manadena. Kirtinaya sadahari. So, of course, some devotees misunderstand this verse and they think thinking of yourself lower than the straw in the street means to think of yourself as horrible. That's called depression. Like, oh, I'm the most horrible devotee. I'm disgusting. I'm like a worm in stool. We don't want to think like that. Basically, that's another side of false ego, because you're still talking about yourself. Hey, look at me, I'm a worm in stool. Because you want attention. Basically, it's like a little kid. Like a little kid, which is all right for a kid, a little kid will be crying because they want attention. Oh, mama. Or they'll do something tricky or something naughty to get attention. Like Krishna even did the same thing. You know, broke the butter pots or did different things like that to get attention. So the idea is that we don't want to think less of ourselves. We want to think of ourselves less. Do you understand the difference? There's a difference. I mean, you have to really understand English grammar, don't you? You don't want to think less. You don't want to go... Like, a devotee went to Prabhupada one time and said, you know, I'm the most fallen. Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. You know, you're not the most anything. So we actually start thinking of Krishna. We talk about Krishna and Prabhupada and great devotees and service to Krishna. But you don't really need to talk about how fallen you are. And sometimes it comes to the extent that the devotees talk about their past sinful activities to show everyone how fallen they were. You know, the brahmacharis get together. Yeah, before I joined the movement, I was a real playboy. And all the girls, and let me tell you about this girl, that girl, that girl. Or, you know, I smoked so much marijuana, you know. And one devotee came to me and said, I was intoxicated for every day for 10 years. And they said, this is what I took. And they described elaborately, you know, the pills, the LSD, another thing called STP, which can put you in intoxication for 1 week without stopping. That was famous during the 1960s. And so, but that's useless talk, isn't it? Yeah, I'm so fallen. You want to hear how fallen I am? Everybody likes to talk about themselves, right? Even if it's something negative. There was actually even one famous comedian who would just talk about how no one loved him. Isn't it? He said, you know, when I go into a room, everybody walks away. You know, he would talk about it like that. So that's still self-centeredness. So we shouldn't be bragging, and that we shouldn't be talking about ourselves that much.
A lot of time, I think devotees misunderstand the actual meaning of being humble. They think by doing this, we are trying to prove they are humble.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I'm so humble, I'm proud of it. You ever seen anyone as humble as me? So that's not humility. You know, humility means to think more about Krishna. You know, true humility means to accept what Krishna wants rather than what you think you want. So any other questions?
Is it positive bragging?
Positive what? Positive bragging. Oh, you attended my seminar. You heard about my seminar. So, instead of fishing for a compliment. No, positive bragging is that it's a need for appreciation, not for a need for praise. There's a difference between appreciation and praise. You know, praise is like a general thing. Like, you are so wonderful. You are so great. You know, you're amazing. These are all general things. But for someone to appreciate the service that you did, not to praise you. I mean, it's a fine line between the two. That, you know, if someone appreciates, you know, thank you for helping. I mean, for example, sometimes people say, thank you. You know, I get cards sometimes. You know, thank you for keeping me in Krishna consciousness. So I don't take it that, you know, I'm so great when I read that. I take it that I'm really happy that I was able to connect them with Krishna because it fulfilled one of my basic needs to connect people with Krishna. So if it's basically based on the need fulfillment, you know, you're connecting someone with Krishna or you're helping someone in some way or other, then that's more of an appreciation thing. It's like a thank you, you know, please and thank you type of thing.
For something specific.
But the general praise or wanting to be, yeah, wanting profit adoration distinction. You know, just wanting to be seen as something special is something we want to avoid. But for, you know, appreciation, like if someone says, you know, you said this in class and it really helped me understand more about Krishna consciousness, that inspires me to be more Krishna conscious myself and inspires me to help people. Anything that inspires you to help people and continue being serving Krishna is actually useful in Krishna consciousness. But anything that inspires you to think more about yourself is harmful in Krishna consciousness. So that's a distinction. You know, with the effect that it has on you, whether it inspires you in one way or the other. So any other questions? No? Yeah.
When Vamana Dev was
Bali Maharaj's sister was Ratna something. Ratnamala. Yeah. Not any relationship to anyone here. But anyway, Radhamala, she looked at Lord Vamana and just basically had this maternal instinct in relationship to him. And she thought I'd really like to have him as my son. But then when he tricked her brother, she became angry and she said, well, he may be my son, but I want to kill him too. So as a result, she appeared as Putana. That was Putana's history. And then because he had that maternal affection, Krishna accepted that and ignored the demoniac intention, and she was able to go to the spiritual world to be one of Krishna's mothers in the spiritual world. It's nice, isn't it? Krishna is really merciful. Hey Krishna Kanana Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute. Krishna is an ocean of mercy, so even if one approaches him to kill him, he's thinking of the person's welfare. Imagine that. So if you have to hate someone, hate Krishna. Because at least you're meditating on it. Because it's not favorable. It's not anukulyena, it's pratipulyena. It's not favorable. But still, it's better than nothing. Just like Krishna was. Like sometimes that. There was one story where someone was dying, someone's mother was dying, she said, "Where is your Krishna? Your Krishna's not here." She was saying to her daughter. And so at the time of death, she said, "Krishna. Where's your Krishna?" And she probably went back to daughter. So if you really have animosity towards God, just focus it on Krishna. Yeah, he liberated. Yeah, because he wanted to imitate Krishna. He said to Krishna, "Give up your implements." I mean, in other words, symbols of Vishnu. And Krishna said to him, "I'll give him up, but first you got to catch my Sudarshan chakra." So he threw his chakra, and that was it. The guy's head was cut off, and he went back to Godhead. He got a sarupya mukti, which means the mukti of looking like the Lord in the spiritual world. It's nice, isn't it? Krishna's so merciful. Oh, what a nice God that you can even hate him when you go back to God. As long as you acknowledge he exists. If you don't acknowledge he exists, you don't go back to God. But if you hate him, you go back to God. Or you love him, you go back to God. Pretty good, isn't it? That's real mercy. So, I guess that's it, right? You got to take it today, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.